You are listening to WXOJLP
in Northampton, Massachusetts.
Tonight I want to take a few minutes to discuss a grave threat to peace.
To protect the haves from the have-nots.
The threat comes from America's determination to lead the world, its history of aggression, and its drive toward an arsenal of terror.
To maintain the security of those who accumulate wealth from the labor of others.
El imperialismo norteamericano.
To protect wealth from the poverty that wealth creates.
Freedom is the universal gift of Almighty God.
The God-given promise that all are equal, all are free.
How do you think he'll react to you when you learn what a real revolution is?
I do not believe that a few people should control the wealth of any land, that it should be a collective ownership.
Fellow citizens, your enemy is ruling your country, and war is what they got.
Today, this is as good as it's going to get in Iraq.
Human rights are subordinated to the overwhelming, overriding need of profit.
We believe that as a people living in the United States, it is our responsibility to resist the injustices done by our government in our name.
We must be prepared to match actions with words by seeking out every creative method of protest possible.
Gotta take the power back.
Welcome to this week's edition of Seeing Red Radio, the radio show with a revolutionary socialist perspective. I'm your host, Anthony Udell. Welcome to the program. On this week's edition of Seeing Red, we'll start off with an analysis of the current state of the anti-war movement by columnist John Walsh in anticipation of the anti-war protests on the 21st of March. Then we'll continue with commentary from Michael Parenti on the Marxism of Reality. We'll also feature excerpts from KPFA's recent five-part series entitled Capitalism and Its Discontents, and we'll also feature a contributor to The Militant, the great organ of the Socialist Workers' Party, Robert Langston, on the dialectics of revolution. That's all in this week's edition of Seeing Red Radio. Please stay tuned.
Gonna make the world safe for democracy, aren't you?
What is democracy?
Well, I gave you the kind of government. It's got something to do with young men killing each other, I believe.
What has been created by this half century of massive corporate propaganda is what's called anti-politics.
Our political leaders like to pretend that there are no classes in this country, that all of us have the same interest, Exxon and me, George Bush and you, but we've always had class struggle.
The development of modern industry cuts from under its feet the very foundation on which the bourgeoisie produces and appropriates products. What the bourgeoisie, therefore, produces above all are its own grave diggers. Its fall and the victory of the proletariat are equally inevitable.
In the Wall Street Journal of January 24th, the loathsome McCarthyite neocon and former Marxist David Horowitz gazed approvingly on the inauguration of Barack Obama. To Horowitz, it meant the removal of an obstacle to war. Thus, he wrote, quote, "Consider, when President Obama commits this nation to war against the Islamic terrorists, as he already has in Afghanistan, he will take millions of previously alienated and disaffected Americans with him, and they will support our troops in a way that most of his party has refused to support them until now." When another liberal, Bill Clinton, went to war from the air, there was no anti-war movement in the streets or in his party's ranks to oppose him. This is an encouraging fact for us. End quote. Horowitz is now locked in fast embrace with Katrina Van Heuvel, editor-in-chief of The Nation magazine, and Leslie Kagan and her cohorts at the United for Peace and Justice. Van den Heuvel's most recent piece in The Nation runs under a title in the form of a query: Obama's war? Whose war does she think it is, anyway? Even the mainstream media calls it Obama's war, sans question mark. Her piece ran shortly after after Obama ordered 17,000 more troops to Afghanistan, and almost a month after both Afghan and Pakistani civilians were first bombed at Obama's orders. She concludes her piece after citing the deployment of additional troops, quote, "Up to this point, the Afghan war belonged to George W. Bush. But Obama's escalation threatens to make it his own. There's still time to change direction. President Obama, don't make this your war. I'm sorry. If the escalation on the AFPAC war, that's the war on Afghanistan and Pakistan, only threatens to make the war Obama's, what will it take to give him ownership? After supporting Obama during the election, when he was very clear about his coming crusade in Afghanistan and having made no attempts in exchange for their support, the liberals are now reduced, their leverage gone, to begging for a change in course. Pity, pathos, disgust, or a sense of betrayal, it's hard to know what to feel when one encounters this stuff. Similarly, Kagan's United for Peace and Justice, dominated by the quote-unquote progressive Democrats of America and the quote-unquote Communist Party of the USA, more or less the same thing, not because the progressive Democrats of America is radical, but because the Communist Party of the United States is not, has been all too silent on Obama's AFPAC war. As a result, there have been discordant rumblings among the rank and file about UFPJs, that's the United for Peace and Justice's failure, to call a national demonstration against the wars flaring from Iraq to Pakistan, and refusal to join the only one called that by answer. That's the Act Now to Stop War and End Racism, who've called for the demonstration on March 21st. The first bombings of the AFPAC war under Obama came on January 23rd, almost a month ago. Bombing a country is an act of war. And last time I looked, Congress had not declared war on Pakistan, thus putting Obama in clear violation of the Constitution. The same crowd calling to indict Bush should also be calling to impeach Obama. Clearly, a national action is called for in protest, but only answer has done so. In fact, until last Friday, Afghanistan was only mentioned in small print on the United for Peace and Justice webpage. Even answer called for a national mobilization. United for Peace and Justice announced local actions for April 4th with no special mention of the AFPAC war. This appears to be an attempt to divert people from the only national action to be called, which will be a major embarrassment to Obama if the numbers are large. And a lot of people on the United for Peace and Justice national discussion groups, the writer of this article included, have been told to shut up when protesting UFPJ's inaction. But Obama's imperialism will not go away despite the tut-tutting of the PC crowd anymore than his kowtowing to the banksters. Let us be clear. I make no special brief for answer. Their exclusionary politics are really not all that different from UFPJ's, which loves to red bait them. This is an amazing thing for those who call themselves quote-unquote communists or quote-unquote progressives to do. But at least answer has not been hypnotized into supporting empire because the Dems are now in the imperial driver's seat. In this act of courage, they resemble the libertarians and Greens and Naderites and many writers at the American Conservative who are consistent and impassioned in their aversion to war. That tells me we need a new and broad-based anti-war movement which is open to one and all with an aversion to empire, no matter their feelings about tax breaks or abortion or national health insurance or anything else. Clearly, UFPJ, the Liberal Democrats, and others of that ilk are incapable of building such a movement. Nor do they want to. We can only hope it will be born. Meanwhile, the writer of the article and myself will be in Washington, D.C. for the answer demonstration on March 21st. For the moment, it is the only game in town now ruled by Emperor Obama and the Democrats. That's an article from the website Dissident Voiced by columnist John Walsh entitled Indict Bush and Impeach Obama. And remember that on March 21st, Answer has called for a march on the Pentagon. There are also other marches that will be occurring in other spots across the country. Of course, remembering that this, in fact, is the 6th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. You're listening to Seeing Red Radio. We'll be right back after all of this.
Are you a homeowner who could benefit Ocean Finance? Why not remortgage your home or pay your money to Ocean? Just treat Ocean Finance to whatever you have. Many already have.
We didn't expect it to go as quick as it did. It went really quickly.
I couldn't actually believe it when it all went They just took it out of our hands.
They did.
So if you're a homeowner interested in raising your existing debts or simply treating yourself to £500 monthly repayment, call us now on 0800 666 or apply online at unmanageabledebts.co.uk. Ocean, helping people into debt.
Those polar bears now, who really cares now? They're breeding gender-bending babies who won't be breeding none, 'cause PCBs, yeah, are in the seas, yeah. We like to think that there's a little piece of us in everyone, 'cause we're Monsanto. That's right, Monsanto. Turning Satan into Santa by giving kiddies cancer. Coming through now, we're changing you now. The Mother Nature Terminators of food and health and hope. That DDT man, don't let on me, man. 'Cause we had all these creepy crawlies falling on the food we grew. Was a revolution, a resolution. It's just a shame that what we sprayed on made the turning toxic too. Let me remind you about Indochina. Then call me dominoes were falling, so they sprayed them into hell. The peasant farmers, orange pajamas. We made their jungle cover wither, then we withered them as well. 'Cause we're Monsanto, that's right, Monsanto. We're turning Satan into Santa by giving kiddies cancer. Coming through now, we're changing you now. The Mother Nature Terminators of food and health and hope. It's not our fault, there's chemical warfare. But if there's dollars in dioxin, it's our duty to supply that plane of poison. They washed our boys in a cancer agent from the sea. Hey, I cannot tell a lie from Pentagon came. That drug is Aspartame, our Pepsi Cola with no calories, was every kiddie's treat when there were rumors. It gave them tumors. Somebody falsified the data, and we called it NutraSweet. And you get more juice now from a dairy moo cow. Monsanto's daily dose of hormones, that udder's gonna swell.
Don't blame the cream though, if you're in chemo.
There may be BSD mastectomies, but nobody can tell. 'Cause we're Monsanto, that's right, Monsanto. We're turning Satan into Santa by giving kiddies cancer. Coming through now, we're changing you now. The Mother Nature Terminators of food and health and hope. Robert Shapiro, well, he's our hero. With a vision of sustainability, which means we're going to keep on growing till we're the biggest corporation in the 21st century. In the future, for the big polluters, he's fan and eco-friendly line and redesigning DNA, genetic eyes on that far horizon, where everything alive is privatized and every seed will pay. We got the soya, we got the lawyers, the politicians in our pockets, all the way to presidents of press and TV, to guarantee cooperation of your nation in our new experiment. You did not choose it, but you'll have to use it. We'll get our Roundup Ready fingerprint in every pie you eat with a big maintenance. Be a bit more blatant. Tell the corporation's domination of your global be complete. Mr. Monsanto, Monster Mutanto, we're turning Satan into Santa. Give everybody cancer.
In 1907, this is what Woodrow Wilson said. 1907, this was, I don't even think he was yet governor of New Jersey. Well, he certainly wasn't president. Maybe he was governor. He was a political science professor and president of Princeton for a while, and then governor of New Jersey, and then president of the United States. In 1907, Woodrow Wilson noted the role that's played by the capitalist state on behalf of private capital. I quote him, "Since trade ignores national boundaries and the manufacturer insists on having the world as a market, the flag of his nation must follow him, and the doors of the nations which are closed against him must be battered down. Concessions obtained by financiers must be safeguarded by ministers of state." Now, you hear that? That's a bourgeois college professor, president of the United States. If I just read that statement, if I said the financiers are serviced by the ministers of state, the ministers of state have to safeguard the financiers. You know what people say? Oh, you're Marxist. Oh, you're Marx. That's Marxist, you know. I hear that all the time. When I was just getting myself radicalized, I used to hear that. I'd say things like, I think racism is actually, you say it's a failure of capitalism. I think it's a success of capitalism because it's used to divide the working class. It's used to suppress wages. And my colleagues would say, that's Marx. That's Marx. I said, Marx? I thought that was Parenti. I look in the mirror. I'd say things like, you know, I don't think the police are neutral. I think why in a strike they side with the factory owners and not the workers? Why are they there defending the property and not the right of the worker who has an entitlement in the labor that he invests? And I said, well, that's Marx. That's Marx. I would hear this all the time. I said, you know, I don't think U.S. policy is so innocent. We're out there helping the finance. Oh, that's Marx, they'd say all the time. And I said, boy, this guy Marx was really something. You know, here I am. I'm knocking myself out trying to make an analysis. Every time I come up with something, they give him the credit. That's pretty good. And then I realized something. That wasn't Marx. That wasn't Parenti. That was reality. That's what it was. And reality happens to be Marxist. So let's repeat that sentence and go on. Woodrow Wilson is talking. Concessions obtained by financiers must be safeguarded by ministers of state, even if the sovereignty of unwilling nations be outraged in the process. Colonies must be obtained or planted in order that no useful corner of the world may be overlooked or left unused. Now, that does sound like Marx, the manifesto. The same wording, he says, capitalism goes into every corner of the world to recreate it in its own image and put it to use for its capital accumulation process. Interesting. Sometimes the flag will go in before the dollars get there, and that's to create new opportunities. For instance, in 1919 in Haiti, the people started a popular rebellion and revolution. They actually built a popular militia to try to get the land back from the landowners, to try to get the big companies out of there and all that. The U.S. declared political instability. They have certain code words, you know, they use. Political instability, undemocratic forces, we got to defend it. Political instability, and of course, racism gets used very handily here. You see, well, these little brown people in this little island have to learn self-governance. You see, so we will have to go down and show them and at least bring law and order and stability back. So they went down just to take care of that. And they stayed a mere 19 years. And they killed 18,000 Haitians. And they also kicked out the French, German, and British companies, and U.S. companies came in. You see, capitalism not only fights the class war against its own laboring class, capital formations will often fight against each other and against other national capital formations. And, of course, the people pick up the tab on that, too.
Send that boy off dime. Yes, it make you wanna holler out home. The way they do your line, make you wanna holler out home. The way they do your life. Hang ups and let down. Understand it all, what the ghetto people mean when they say living behind walls. Well then put on your best suit, white shirt and tie, and run on downtown to stand in line for a job washing dishes that you may not qualify. Walk a big hole in a brand new pair of shoes and you've had your first look at the inner city blues. Go looking for a place to live, but all the while remember what lurks behind the devil's smile. Are we stupid or just naive that we continue to believe money can buy us anything, including a slice of the American dream? Yeah, answer ads in the paper about houses for sale and get treated like Charles Manson out on bail. When you start to get frustrated by the tactics they use, you'll recognize the feeling. It's the inner city blues. Yeah, make you want to holler sometimes and throw up both your hands. And haven't you ever wondered about why some brothers and sisters were down and out, receiving their sympathy from a bottle of wine or worse yet, old homicide, living their lives in a glassine bag or praising the mysteries of Terminal Skag? Some of our brothers parading in drag, another set of victims too whipped to choose. Yeah, you can recognize that, that's the inner city blues. Makes you wanna holler sometimes and throw up both your hands. To see sweet sisters, the blossoms of our African tree, profiling on the corner talking about 10 and 3. Because in spite of all the money we made and taxes we paid, the woman was looking at hungry babes and some decisions had to be made. Could you tell her it's better to go to your grave as a slave at the minimum wage? Well, I hardly think so, but make you wanna holler sometimes and throw up both your hands. What happens when people start to feel they have nothing to lose, 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 nothing to lose. Did you ever hear about Mark Essex and the things that made him choose to fight the inner city blues? Yeah, Essex took to the rooftops guerrilla style and watched while all the crackers went wild. Brought in 600 troops out here, brand new to see them crushed with fear. Essex fought back with 1,000 rounds, and New Orleans was a changing town. And rat-a-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat was the only sound. Yeah, bring on the stone rifles to knock down walls. Bring on the elephant guns. Bring on the helicopters to block out the sun. Yeah, made the devil wanna holler, cause 8 was dead and 12 was down. And cries for freedom were a brand new sound. New York, Chicago, Frisco, L.A. Justice was served and the unjust were afraid. Cause after all the years and all the fears, brothers were alive, the courage found, and spreading them goddamn blues around. Yeah, make you wanna holler, black people, and hold up both your hands and say liberation.
Crime is increasing and trigger happy policing. Panic is spreading. Make you wanna holler sometimes and throw up both of your hands. Make you wanna holler sometimes and throw up in both your hands. Throw up both your hands.
Just as in the 30s, when Capital had been pretty roundly disqualified by a lot of Americans as a real partner in the management of the economy, a lot of Americans and President Roosevelt all viewed corporations as untrustworthy partners in trying to navigate the country out of the Great Depression. And I think you only have to, you know, listen to the latest report from the Congressional Oversight Committee about the TARP money to once again have the sense that there's a lot of reason to be disillusioned with the role that that banks in particular, but that, you know, there's a lot to worry about in terms of, you know, corporations being trusted partners and thinking about helping to guide the country's recovery.
Americans have not been born yet. They're waiting patiently for the past to die. Please give blood. Those crumpled tablets were to share a story with a burning bush. Where is that voice from nowhere to remind us that the holy ground we walk on, purified by native blood, has rooted trees whose fallen leaves now color code a sacred list of demands? Who among us can give translation of autumn hues to morning news? The anchor man thrown overboard has simply rooted us in history's repeating cycle, a nation in its saddened years that won't acknowledge karma. Where is that voice from nowhere, the ones your prophets spoke of? There are voices from fear, disconnected from their diaphragms, dangling from coffee-covered teeth that spill into our laps and scorch our privates. There are voices from the sides of necks, some already noosed, dangling participles, pronouns running for sentence, serving life in corner offices and ghetto corners. Their voices are the same, dead to themselves, numb to the possibility of truth existing beyond that which they can palm in their hands, period. There are voices of elders, which seem to do no more than damn us to our childish ways. For in many households, wisdom no longer comes with age. So where is that voice from nowhere? That burning bush, that passing dove? I hear the voices of generals calling for ammunition, presidents calling for arms, women calling for help. Where is that voice from nowhere? That God of Abraham, can he be heard over the gunfire, the whiz of passing missiles, the crash of buildings, the cries of children, the crack of bones, the shriek of sirens? Or is that his mighty voice, your angry God craving the sacrifice of virgin generation sons degenerate, your holy books written in red ink on burning sands? Your prayers between rounds do no more than fasten the fate of your children to the hammer truth of your trigger. A truth that mushrooms its darkened cloud over the rest of us, so that we too bear witness to the short-lived fate of a civilization that worships a male god. Your weapons are phallic, all of them. That dummy that sits on your lap is no longer a worthwhile spectacle. His shrunken pale face leaves little room for imagination. We have spotted your moving lips and have pinned the voice to its proper source. It is a source of madness, a source of hunger and power, a source of weakness, a source of evil. We have exited your coliseum and are encircling your box office, demanding our families back, our cultures back, our rituals back, our gods back, so that we may return them to their proper source, the source of life, the source of creation, our mother's womb, the great goddess. We will cut through the barbed wire hangers and chastity belts. We will climb in and incubate our spirits through the winter. We will wait through the degenerate course of your repeated history. We will wait for the past to die.
Now, the change in meaning of certain words over a long period of time can be instructive. And this is especially true of the terms revolution and dialectic, and their cognates in other languages. Revolutionum in ancient and medieval Latin, for example, primarily connoted almost the exact opposite of drastic change, of a violent interruption in continuity. The term meant primarily circular motion, endless repetition of the same, a meaning preserved in the modern English in the cognate revolve, and in such phrases as revolutions per minute. The apparent motion of the heavenly bodies around the earth was the very model of revolutionum. And well into the 18th century, this seems to have been the predominant meaning of the term in English. The first literary occurrence of it in the sense of a political upheaval appears to have been in 1600. The word dialectic, too, has almost reversed its meaning since antiquity. For Plato, dialegomai meant, as its etymology suggests, a talking through, a discussion in which opinions were counterposed and mutually criticized until the eternal, self-sufficient, self-identical form or idea, the true being of the thing under discussion, became evident to the discussion partners, a truth which was all the time present in their souls and preserved in language, but which had been obscured by the shifting, deceptive veil of sense experience and human passion and action. For the modern dialectician, however, it is precisely the essence of things that, although structured and lawful, is temporal, self-contradictory, and deeply entwined with every other thing, while it is the rigid forms or ideas in our souls generated by historical social processes and shaping sense experience and determining language accordingly that obscure the truth of things. Plato, for example, wrote two or possibly three dialogues, dialectical investigations, of the state. Though they are quite different from one another in form and conclusion, in each one, Plato seeks to define the form or ideal of the state, of which every empirical state, every state we meet someplace in time and space, is a partially real, partially unreal image or reflection, and through which every empirical state can be judged. And this essence or inner reality of the state is, for Plato, justice, which, in turn, is defined in a way that strikingly resembles the division of labor and the class structure of classical Greek society. Marx, the modern dialectician, began the independent development of dialectical materialism with a criticism of just the aspect of Hegel's thought where, as we shall see, he most blatantly betrays the dialectic and most remarkably resembles Plato, his theory of the state. Through this criticism, Marx was able to establish that the state, in its essence, is no eternal idea which empirical states more or less closely approximate, but nothing more or less than the historical sequence of empirical states comprehended as the necessary institutionalized violence required to maintain the cohesiveness of specific, antagonistic, class-divided societies.
Missiles flying in the third world towards the people stranded on their knees. Bombs falling over Baghdad, killing children who are starving by degrees. There are those of us who'd question, what's the goal and what's the cost? 600,000 dead malnourished children, a UN-sanctioned Holocaust. Missiles flying in the third world, from Hanoi to Wounded Knee. Bombs falling over Baghdad, and each one shouts, democracy. Contras, kings and generals, brandish stars and stripes. From Rangoon to Los Angeles, selling oil, guns and crack pipes. Missiles flying in the third world, and each one will kill a child. Bombs falling over Baghdad, and hunger and death is running wild. We had to destroy the village in order to save it, to help this jungle grow. First we had to pave it. Fits and starts are everywhere. From the mountains of Chiapas to the streets of Central Square, empires fall. This one will too. So here's to the day when this one is through.
David Rovix right here on Seeing Red Radio with Contras, Kings, and Generals. Within days of receiving $25 billion in federal bailout money paid for with your tax dollars, Bank of America hosted a conference call of corporate executives and conservatives to strategize about how to defeat the Employee Free Choice Act, also known as EFCA. Corporations have declared war on EFCA because of both its specific provisions and the symbolic role it could play in revitalizing the labor movement. If EFCA passes, union recognition by employers would be automatic whenever 50% plus one of workers in a given workplace sign union cards, which is why the process is often referred to as a card check. The legislation would also provide for greater penalties for companies that violate workers' rights to organize. President Barack Obama has said he would sign EFCA into law. The legislation could play a role similar to Section 7A of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's National Recovery Act, which enshrined into federal law the right to organize and buoyed the formation of mass industrial unions. Labor organizers seized the moment to argue that the president wants you to join the union. The class-conscious members of America's corporate elite have no intention of repeating this experience. Home Depot founder Bernie Marcus said, "EFCA is the demise of civilization. This is how a civilization disappears," he said. During the 2008 elections, Marcus declared that corporate executives, quote, should be shot if they don't do their part to reelect at-risk Republican senators who could filibuster and prevent EFCA's passage. While no corporate executives appear to have been shot as of yet, EFCA's enemies have marshaled a war chest of at least $100 million, according to union estimates. Companies are using every means at their disposal to build opposition. For example, McDonald's publicly directed all franchise owners to lobby Congress against EFCA. Predictably, Walmart, the largest employer in the United States, has also joined the battle. In August, Federal Election Commission complaints were filed, alleging the company illegally instructed employees to vote Republican and against Barack Obama in order to stop EFCA. On Christmas Eve, the Beast of Bentonville even announced it was suddenly settling 63 lawsuits brought by current and former employees to the tune of $640 million. Why? The Wall Street Journal reported that Walmart decided to pay out in order to improve its image before the battle against EFCA. Meanwhile, Republican mouthpieces in Congress are mindlessly repeating talking points created by anti-union think tanks and quote-unquote advocacy organizations. The lies of shadowy front groups, as David Moberg describes them in These Times, have wormed their way through the mainstream media and begun to shape the debate around EFCA, even though the political terrain should overwhelmingly favor EFCA's supporters. The names of these employer groups are perfect examples of Orwellian doublespeak. Americans for Job Security, the Employee Freedom Action Committee, and the Coalition for a Democratic Workplace. The longer-standing anti-labor Center for Union Facts is also waging a full frontal attack against EFCA, again, the Employee Free Choice Act. Union Facts is headed by D.C. lobbyist and Antichrist Richard Berman, who also heads up the Employee Freedom Action Committee. The CBS news program 60 Minutes once called Berman, quote-unquote, Dr. Evil for his efforts on behalf of the alcohol, fast food, and tobacco industries. In just 1 week, in June of 2007, Union Facts spent $500,000 against the Employee Free Choice Act. For its part, the Employee Freedom Action Committee has announced a $30 million anti-EFCA campaign. One of the biggest fronts, the so-called Coalition for a Democratic Workplace, claims to be a coalition of workers, employers, associations, and organizations opposed to EFCA. In reality, it includes 500 employer and business organizations such as the American Beverage Association, the National Association of Manufacturers, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the American Meat Institute, and Mississippi Manufacturers Association. As Bill Samuel, the Director of Political Affairs for the AFL-CIO, wrote in the Washington newsletter The Hill, quote, "What should we make of a group that calls itself the Coalition for a Democratic Workplace? That sounds like something I might be in favor of. Are these people really trying to give workers more say in the workplace? Heck, that's what unions do. Actually, that is most definitely not what the Coalition for a Democratic Workplace tries to accomplish. Just look at who its members are. The coalition is made up of groups such as the Retail Industry Leaders Association, whose biggest member is the notoriously anti-union Walmart,
the Associated Builders and Contractors, an association of anti-union contractors, the National Association of Manufacturers, and yes, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. These groups do have a track record on issues that involve giving workers more say in the workplace. Not surprisingly, they're not for that.
We gonna roll, we gonna roll, we gonna roll a union on. We gonna roll, we gonna roll, we gonna roll a union on. If the planner's in the way, we gonna roll it over him, gonna roll it over him, gonna roll it over him. If the planner's in the way, we gonna roll it over him, gonna roll the union on. We gonna roll, we gonna roll, we gonna roll the union on. We gonna roll, we gonna roll, we gonna roll the union on. If the boss is in the way, we gonna roll it over him, gonna roll it over him, gonna roll it over him. If the boss is in the way, we gonna roll it over him, roll the union on. We gonna roll, we gonna roll, we gonna roll the union on. We gonna roll, we gonna roll, we gonna roll the union on.
Unfortunately, the Employee Free Choice Act's enemies have had an impact on the debate despite the growing support for unions and the growing disrepute of corporations like Bank of America. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting and Colorado Media Matters have documented significant disinformation percolating through the mainstream media. The anti-Employee Free Choice Act head-fixing industry has been based on four key lies. But union members and supporters can demolish their arguments once they have the facts in hand. So here we go. Lie number one. A majority of workers oppose the Employee Free Choice Act, known as EFCA. The Coalition for a Democratic Workplace has released a poll claiming that 73% of Obama voters oppose EFCA. However, the poll was carefully and unscientifically worded in order to ensure a negative result. In fact, the poll contradicts a mountain of evidence, including more professionally worded surveys which show widespread support for unions. For example, a Hart Research Associates survey found that 78% of Americans would favor legislation making it easier for employees to bargain with employers over wages, working conditions, and benefits, in other words, the things a union does. In other surveys, nearly three-quarters of respondents have favored allowing workers to form unions if a majority sign union cards, a central provision of the Employee Free Choice Act. And several polls have shown a majority of non-union workers would join a union if they had a chance. Polls even show that around three-quarters of people support EFCA itself when the key provisions of the legislation are explained. Lie number two. The Employee Free Choice Act would abolish workers' rights to a secret ballot in forming a union. My God, haven't we all seen this commercial? EFCA in no way prohibits the use of ballots in forming a union. The fact is that the 1935 Wagner Act provided for two primary methods for organizing unions. One, a card check, and the National Labor Relations Board election process. Card check allows for a union to be brought into a workplace when a majority of employees sign union cards. The National Labor Relations Board election process is a government-supervised election in a particular bargaining unit held after a certain number of employees signed union cards. From the 1930s into the 1970s, the majority of unions were organized through the card check process. But since the onset of the employers' offensive in the late 1970s, companies realized they could force workers to use the National Labor Relations Board election process in order to draw out organization drives, intimidate workers, and peel off union support. This has been a successful strategy for corporate America. One academic study of union elections from 1999 to 2004 showed that in cases when a majority of workers supported unions and signed union cards, they were only able to win National Labor Relations Board elections 20% of the time. In truth, the current setup forces workers, in the face of the boss's opposition and intimidation, to organize a union twice. Further, the Employee Free Choice Act does not abolish employees' rights to a secret ballot in the National Labor Relations Board's election process. Instead, it gives the choice of card check or the election process to workers instead of the bosses. Nevertheless, this lie has spread unchecked throughout sections of the mass media. For example, CNN's Lou Dobbs recently asserted that card check would end secret ballot in union elections and that the so-called Employee Free Choice Act is a bold threat. This should prove that Lou Dobbs, for all his talk about defending hardworking Americans, is not only a racist immigrant basher, but anti-labor, period. Let's go to line number three. The Employee Free Choice Act will expose workers to intimidation by unions. In the December USA Today, it is hard to see how ending the secret ballot will do much besides initiating campaigns of subtle and not-so-subtle intimidation as workers contemplate their decisions, end quote. This media regurgitation of Coalition for Democratic Workplace talking points turns reality on its head. It's bosses who use intimidation during the union organizing campaigns, not unions. A 2007 Center for Economic and Policy Research study found 1 in 5 workers were illegally terminated when they attempted to organize a union at their workplace. The House Committee on Education and Labor reported that in 2005 alone, more than 30,000 workers were receiving back pay from employers that had illegally persecuted them for union activity. This undoubtedly understates the scale of the problem, since proving employer violations is a difficult and time-consuming process. Even serious business studies have shown that the cases of so-called union intimidation are minuscule in number. And finally, line number four. The Employee Free Choice Act is, in words of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, a job killer. The idea that EFCA would further strangle an already hard-hit job market flies in the face of economic reality and even the opinion of countless mainstream economists, such as the New York Times columnist and Nobel Prize winner Paul Krugman. One of the factors in the deepening economic crisis is a sharp decline in consumer demand. While the credit crunch is causing companies to scale back investments, economically wounded consumers can't afford to buy goods and services, leading businesses to scale back more or move toward bankruptcy, shedding workers and creating more unemployment, which further curtails demand. Washington's roughly $800 billion stimulus package was supposed to put a check on this vicious cycle. As Krugman has argued, since unionized workers tend to have greater job security and receive greater wages and benefits, unions are essentially a stimulus package that costs taxpayers nothing. A 2007 study showed this clearly. Median weekly earnings for union members were $886 prior to the crisis, but just $691 for non-union workers. Employer opposition to the Employee Free Choice Act isn't about the health of the economy or stemming job loss, even though declining demands means they are increasingly unable to sell goods and services. In truth, companies are caught in an economic catch-22. Their capitalist competition, every employer is compelled to extract as much surplus value as possible out of their workers. Failure to do so means that rival companies will benefit at their expense. As a result, corporate executives must try to maintain dictatorial control over production and exploit labor as they see fit. For that reason, unions are anathema to them. Capital is right to be worried. The pull-yourself-up-by-the-bootstraps ideology of the past 3 decades was dealt a blow by the ongoing federal bailout of the financial system, and the economic crisis makes a rise in class struggle increasingly certain. Significantly, 2008 saw a second straight year of modest but definite union growth in the United States. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reported union density grew from 12.1% of the workforce to 12.4%, an increase of 428,000 workers for a total of 16.1 million union members. However, labor and the left can't be complacent. The uptick in union membership, while real, is still far below the historic high of about 35% in the 1950s, when labor was able to set industry standards for workers' wages and benefits. Since then, unions have been in a steep decline, not only because of economic restructuring that has cost union jobs, because labor failed to follow production into the South, where most former slave states are virtually union-free. Now, the prolonged economic crisis has put hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of union jobs on the chopping block. Hundreds of thousands more unionized manufacturing jobs are likely to be lost. Furthermore, public sector unions, where organized labor has its greatest success in recent decades, will be increasingly hit by budget cuts and job losses as tax revenues plummet at the state and local level. Despite the pressures of a terrible economy, advocates of EFCA have political momentum. The mainstream political shift towards liberalism has opened up new space for labor and for pro-union legislation like EFCA. Much of the Democratic-controlled Congress is on record of supporting EFCA, and President Barack Obama has probably issued more pro-union statements than Roosevelt. All this makes passage of EFCA possible. But as the debate around the stimulus package showed, we can't risk allowing the Republicans and the right wing to shape the political debate about EFCA, and there is already plenty of cause for concern. For example, quote-unquote realistic politicians are wavering in their support of Obama's pick for Secretary of Labor, Hilda Solis, because of her past support for EFCA. Some progressive journalists have even suggested dumping the more controversial parts of EFCA, like card check, in order to win passage of the legislation. This would needlessly concede the terms of the debate to the likes of the National Association of Manufacturers and the Coalition for a Democratic Workplace. Most worrisome, it's entirely unclear whether the two labor federations, the AFL-CIO and Change to Win Coalition, are willing or able to mobilize the sort of grassroots struggle needed to shift the debate around EFCA and put real pressure on the politicians. The potential is clearly there for a mass movement for the Employee Free Choice Act. A February 17th meeting called by the Chicago Federal of Labor in support of the legislation drew so many people that hundreds had to be turned away from a union hall that normally seats 1,000. At the same time, however, the willingness of the United Auto Workers, once the standard bearer of the U.S. labor movement, to give up its right to strike in support of the government auto bailout could be a harbinger of even worse compromises to come. The enemies of EFCA are take-no-prisoners CEOs, as they spend millions of dollars and marshal all of their resources to defeat card check. It should be clear that they aren't going to go quietly into the long night. So for labor, lobbying and fine words simply won't be enough. It will take protests and pickets that tap into the growing public energy and support of the Employee Free Choice Act. In fact, the way to win the Employee Free Choice Act is being shown by our side's most class-conscious fighters. For example, the Republic Windows and Doors Workers, represented by the United Electrical Radio and Machine Workers of America, are building support for the Employee Free Choice Act as they tour the country to spread the lessons of their successful factory occupation last December. As organizer for United Electrical, Leah Freed remarked at one such event, quote, "If Republic workers hadn't had a union, nothing would have happened. Laws like the Employee Free Choice Act are imperative at a time when corporations are cutting jobs and laying off thousands." You're listening to Seeing Red Radio. That was an article from, again, the blog Dissident Voice by Adam Turrell entitled "The Enemy of Unions and the Lies They Tell." We only have a few moments left in the program. We're going to see if we can fit in this little bit from that great series put out by KPFA entitled "Capitalism and Its Discontents" on a group calling themselves the Flying Pickets. So we'll try and get that in. Stay tuned.
I'm Gifford Hartman. I work with a group called the Flying Picket. We're a solidarity group that supports strikers and people who are facing evictions and things like that.
My name is Gerard Jamin, and I'm similarly with Flying Picket and a graduate student in history at SF State right now.
One thing we really want to join together with people and fight against is the number of people facing evictions due to foreclosures that, as we all know, is racing across this country. So we've been visiting areas that have been pretty hard hit with the foreclosure crisis, and we've also been meeting people and trying to organize in solidarity with them. We've been out to the Central Valley and visited cities that, in 2007, the number one city in the U.S. was Modesto. We went out to Modesto. Some of our friends and comrades out there took us on a tour and showed us really hard-hit areas and pointed us to other cities. There's a place called Mountain House, which is a brand new development, and 90% of the units are underwater, meaning people owe more on them than they're worth.
I went down there for, there was a group of anarchists in Modesto. They did something called the People's Bailout, where they organized workshops in order to kind of, they invited a bunch of people there. They put up flyers all over the city, inviting people to find out about the crisis and how they can deal with it. And they also organized food and clothing donations. So there was hot food, and there was also donated food and lots of clothing. And a good 100 or so people showed up, and they were in really serious need. Hanging out with people who were in this really, you know, dire need, you really get a sense of how quickly it's spreading. I mean, there were people who had been you know, they were kind of in more hardcore, you know, poverty situations, and other people who seems like they had just on the verge or were just kind of falling into this really precarious situation.
And my experience in Modesto and some of the other cities in the valley is I drove by, I didn't actually go in any houses, but they were pointed out, and people were really trying to stay under the radar, because in the United States, property is sacrosanct, and you're not supposed to take over property. But in a lot of the neighborhoods, the neighbors who still remain legally housed don't want to see the neighborhood fall apart. They don't want to see it deteriorate. So they've actually supported the families that once lived in the places but have been evicted moving back in, to the point that they've actually run extension cables across yards when they've cut off the electricity. Some cities in the Central Valley have made it illegal to live in any kind of residence that has no water. They say it's a health and safety thing, but it's also a way to push people out who are squatting. So people devise ways to illegally turn the water back on and to keep all the, you know, the necessities of life functioning in these houses. So there's a lot of solidarity that happens in these neighborhoods where if it could be a domino effect, if people start getting evicted and the places get boarded up or they get raided by people who go in and salvage the copper wires and copper pipes, it could really bottom the neighborhood out. So neighbors have actually started supporting people moving back in and squatting, and that's a really positive sign.
I came home, and a couple weeks later, somebody sent me a link to this congresswoman named Marcy Kaptur from Ohio, who's actually encouraging people to squat in their own homes rather than being forced out through a foreclosure. And her logic is that, you could watch this online, her logic is essentially these banks who are forcing you to leave your house may be guilty of crimes themselves. You know, there's investigations going on. You know, we don't know. You should have the piece of paper that says that, you know, who you're paying this money to. But until they provide this paper, and even then, you know, don't leave your house. The best bet is to stay and fight. Definitely inspired by the study we've both been making of actions from the 1930s, and specifically around housing, some of which, you know, you could see like in the film version of Grapes of Wrath, for example, where people would help each other out with foreclosures. There's also a famous passage from Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison where, you know, there's a group of people that are being evicted and another group of people that try to basically unevict them. So there's plenty of examples from that period of time. And we're starting to see these kinds of responses reemerge now. And so, you know, for me, that's really exciting, a very basic, direct response to the crisis that we want to, you know, try to support.
A week ago Wednesday, we went into West Oakland, and we went to an Acorn Action, and a family who had been tenants had been paying rent, but the landlord had gone into foreclosure. And that happened back in the early summer. And they didn't know that the place was getting foreclosed upon, so they actually ended up getting a notice after the fact, and they were being told they were being evicted, and they ended up fighting. And Acorn put a call out, and about 35 people showed up at 6 a.m., and behind the scenes, Acorn was negotiating with the lender to try and do something, and it ended up being that the man of the couple was eligible for a VA loan and ended up buying the house. So it was a success story, but it also showed that it was a community mobilization, just like Jerry was saying back in the 30s, what people were doing. The 30s was an incredible time because...
Yes, the 1930s was an absolutely incredible time, and let's hope we can bring those radical moments back to the present. You've been listening to Seeing Red Radio that came from KPFA, put out a 5-part series entitled Capitalism and Its Discontents. Well, that wraps it up for this edition of Seeing Red Radio. Thank you for tuning in. If you want links to the music and the articles that you heard, go to seeingredradio.org. I'm going to leave you with a little Rage Against the Machine with the fine folks at Tool right here on Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP.
To treat the essence of the state, Marx showed, as any kind of eternal entity, really involves selecting some feature of the existing society, idealizing it, and treating it as something inherent in an equally eternal, purportedly, human nature. Theoretically, such a procedure closes off the possibility of understanding the origin and the development of the feature that has been so selected, Plato's justice, which in reality is the social relations of classical Greek slave-based commercial military society, or Hegel's objective reason, which, as we shall see, in reality is the laws governing a commodity-producing society. And practically, such a procedure renders revolutionary action logically impossible, for in the feature that has been selected and idealized, there is an absolute limit which human beings cannot overstep.